Mrs. Steve Maxner conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Richard Dietra on the 1st of July, the year 2000, at 9:30 a.m. in Washington, D.C., at the Marriott. All right, Mr. Dietra, please begin by giving a brief biographical sketch of yourself.
I was born in Minneapolis, Swedish Hospital, on January 29, 1947. Ancestry was Scandinavian, Norwegian, Swedish, and French on my father's side. Very conservative. Went to school in South Minneapolis. After graduating in 1965, the U.S. Army was drafting at that time, and a good percentage of all the guys in my graduating class were drafted. And at that time, we thought it was the right thing to do, to go into the military. Our fathers fought in World War II, our grandfathers World War I. There was no anti-war movement in Minneapolis at that time. So we signed up for the draft, took a train from Minneapolis to Fort Lewis, Washington, is where we had basic training. Did 6 weeks there, I believe, and then we didn't get a leave. They flew us directly to Fort Polk, Louisiana, which was commonly referred to as Tiger Land. It was the birthplace of combat infantrymen for Vietnam. There was a huge sign right over the main gate. My MOS was 11 Bravo, Light Weapons Infantry. We were trained with weapons, you know, infantry training there at Fort Polk. After that training, that was 6 weeks. I got a 30-day leave, went back to Minneapolis, and then I flew out to Oakland and left from Oakland on a Pan Am, and 18 hours later landed in Benoit. I went with two other fellows that were close friends from my hometown. And another fellow was from Washington that we had gone through training together, and they pretty much usually split you up, but three of us stuck together. Ended up at the 90th Replacement Center in Long Bend, and we stayed there probably for 10 days. We were pretty scared. I remember shaving my head. I was afraid of getting bugs in my hair at that time. And at the time, there was an influx of aviation units coming into in country, and they were building up aviation assets. So at the time, they needed 11 Bravo MOSs to pull security guard for these aviation units. So I was lucky. They called my name and my buddy's names, and we got sent to an aviation unit and pulled security guard at night at a place called Dao Chiang, which is in 3rd Corps. We were assigned to the 188th Assault Helicopter Company, Black Widows, and the gun platoon was the Spiders. Those were the call signs also.
Go back real quick. When you received your draft notice, you said that part of your mentality was, well, this is something that was just expected and understood.
Yeah.
What did your family think about it, though? Your mom, your dad, the fact that you were drafted and you were going to be going to Vietnam?
They really didn't say much about it. See, at that time, I mean, parents didn't talk much about the war stuff. My dad never talked about World War II, which I thought was strange. Kind of closed-lipped about the war. No, they were behind me. They thought at that time that they were brainwashed to the point where, you know, it was okay to go in the military. I'm sure once my dad spent his 4 years in the Army, or I mean in the Navy, he probably got a better feel for our government, how it works, and, you know. But they were behind what I was doing. They were fearful for me going and possibility of getting killed over there.
What about your brother? Did you have brothers and sisters?
I had a sister, but she had moved. She was 5 years older than I was, and she moved out of Minneapolis when she graduated from high school in 1960. So she was out of the picture. She had her own things going on. She moved to California, so I didn't see too much of my sister. You know, from that point on, our roads were completely different.
Did you have any friends that voiced opinions that were, you know, questioning why we should go to Vietnam, why we were going to Vietnam, and why we were involved in Vietnam?
Not that I recall.
Okay. So pretty uniform support throughout the whole community, family and community.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, the training that you received when you went to basic training, what were the major pluses and what were the major problems with that training?
Well, infantry training was probably the toughest training you're going to get, because best physical shape I was ever in my life. Mm-hmm. They teach you all the skills of killing, tactics, infantry tactics, weapons.
Mm-hmm. Any problems while you were there, though, in terms of discipline or anything like that?
No. No, I went with the program. You could see the guys that were making waves.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
There were some people making waves.
Yeah, there were certain, well, what they wanted to do at that, if you're going to break, they want to break you during training. Mm-hmm. They didn't want you to break when you're in combat, so that's why the training was so hard. Mm-hmm. You know, they were on you all the time. If you're doing, anytime you fucked up, or even if you didn't fuck up, there'd be someone in your face, you'd have your heels locked, you'd be doing push-ups, mm-hmm. running, trying to break you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I knew what they were trying to do, and I was perceptive enough to just go with the program. I mean, you're still going to end up doing all this shit, mm-hmm. even if you don't make waves. But the guys that did make waves, there was a few guys that got shipped out. I mean... Mm-hmm. I don't know what happened with or how they got out. They just or what rating they gave them.
Mm-hmm. What did were there any physical encounters between trainees and trainers? If someone got too far out of line, they.
I vaguely remember that a couple times guys got in fights with the sergeants, but they wouldn't. They tried to keep that hush hush.
Oh, yeah.
They could just go out behind the barracks and, you know, there was. You know, it's like anything, you know, there's either, you know that these guys, that's their job, is to hound you. Mm-hmm. But there's a way of doing it, you know, without, you know, really dumping on you. Yeah. There were some jerks, and, you know, they got called out a few times. And I never got into any altercations with stuff. Well, I did it at basic. Our drill sergeant was alcoholic. So we had to deal with his hangovers every morning in formation. He was a jerk. So, you know, we had words a few times, and I was basically on a shit list. I used to get extra duty, and, mm-hmm. you know, it just made it rough for me. But it was more of a personal thing. Well, all that stuff ends up personal if you get in someone's face. So those were the types of encounters that would turn ugly, is when it got personal like that. Mm-hmm.
And did you think your weapons training and the other training you received was appropriate and effective in preparing you for what you went on to later, and especially on to Vietnam?
No. No, because I was trained for the infantry, and I got put in as an aviation guy with no training as a door gunner. Mm-hmm. All my training was on the job. So I had 6 months of military training that they paid for. That just, I could thrown it out the window as soon as I got off the jet. Hmm. The only reason I got into that unit is because I had an infantry MOS, and that's security guards that were 11 Bravos. Hmm. So that's how we got basically into the unit, and then after 30 days of doing security guard, the good thing when we were at Dow Chiang, when you pull guard duty all night, you're off during the day, so we go over to the swimming pool. Hmm. And then you're in the middle of a combat zone. We were in the Michelin rubber plantation, so there's rubber trees. It was partially a part of our company area, so we had shade. I mean, talk about decadent, you know, you get off guard duty, Right across the road from us, the VC-controlled village of Daochang. It's off-limits. We know it's VC-controlled. The whole area was... The government had written off that area of 3 Corps in the 20s as VC-controlled. So here we arrive in 1967, like we're going to change what's going on in this area. I mean, what's wrong with this picture? We don't speak the language. We don't know the culture. We weren't given any kind of... They might have given us a few briefings on do's and don'ts, but they really didn't tell us much about the Vietnamese culture. So you could be out... You might insult somebody without even knowing it. Mm-hmm. You know, because their cultures are so different, you know, American and Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. I lost my train of thought now. Where were we?
Well, just the training that you'd received prior
to training.
Going to Vietnam was not appropriate.
It was not. Not at all. I mean, basic knowledge of tactics, weapons, was something I needed. I mean, the tactics wouldn't unless I got shot down and was on the ground. But I'm in the air. So I had to learn, I had to be retrained on the job under combat conditions to learn my job, which is, you know, it was the thrill of a lifetime flying. It was probably the greatest year of my life, besides the, you know, everyone thought they were bulletproof over there. You know, I ain't going to get hit. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did take a roundup, came up through the floor and lodged in my boot in the sole. I got a picture of it here somewhere. That's the closest I got to actually getting hit in my body. I mean, rounds went through the aircraft close by. You could hear them, mm-hmm. you know, penetrating the ship, coming up through the floor. Always sat on a bulletproof vest. We had bulletproof vests. That's what these deals were. Mm-hmm. This was, that was the last time I came to the wall. That was in 92. But anyway, this is what we wore. They're called chicken plates.
Mm-hmm.
There's one, there's sleeves. They fit down into a harness. You had one on the back, one on the front. But what we did, we had we took the back plate out and sat on it because we didn't want to get shot in the balls.
Yeah.
Because all your fire is mostly coming from underneath.
Right.
And then you figure the gunner's on the right. Gunner always flew on the right side. The back crew chief was on the left. Mm-hmm. You had your aircraft commander up in the front, left seat, and then the Peter pilot flew in front of the door gunner. So we're back-to-back, the transmissions between us. Mm-hmm. So we figured we didn't need our back plates because this guy's got his on.
Right.
That was how
yeah.
we were thinking.
Oh, yeah. It's logical.
Yeah. So that's how we got around. Now, well, we could cover the old family jewels.
Okay.
But as far as back to the training, just the weapons. Yeah, I qualified expert in M60. In training, that was my best weapon, so I know that had something to do with my getting on as a door gunner, because mm-hmm. that was my primary weapon for the whole year. It was M60, the best weapon that the Army ever made.
Mm-hmm.
Firepower is unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing when that M60 is working. And we used to have every fifth round was a tracer, or we could get at the ammo points, we could get solid tracers. And they had these other ones. They had green tips. They were piggyback. It was a double round.
Wow.
On the same, you know,
mm-hmm.
round.
Mm-hmm.
7.62, mm-hmm. like a 308 round.
Mm-hmm.
And we used those too. I mean, it was devastating. But I'm getting off here on some other stuff, I guess.
Well, no. Training environment. Were there any accidents or casualties or problems?
Training environment. Well, down at Polk, there's a few guys, because this is on the Louisiana-Texas border.
Yeah.
Hot. That part of it was good. Kind of got us ready for Vietnam. Because when we got off the plane, Vietnam was like walking into an oven. It was that hot. Few guys got cottonmouth snake bites mm-hmm. during training. Little heat exposure.
No, nobody shot, nobody injured by grenades or anything like that?
No.
Okay.
We didn't use live ammo out on the exercises.
Unless it was just...
unless you're at the firing range. There wouldn't be any live ammo out on these exercises. Just because of that, accidents happening like that. But you're not watching what you're doing, you're going to shoot your buddy.
Yep. Anything else stand out about training? Anything you wish they had taught you before you went to Vietnam that they didn't? Besides the being a door gunner?
Well, I was so naive at that time. You know, I'm a young man at 20 years old. I didn't know much about anything, really. And even the... We used to joke about going to Vietnam. I mean, we tried to make a joke out of it so that we wouldn't feel so scared. We knew it. It's like you do all this training, but you don't... It means nothing until you that first time that you come under fire in combat, how you're going to react. They try to train you to react. That was part of the infantry training. But it's like being in class and... until you actually do it, it doesn't have much of a meaning. It's, I don't know how I can describe that. It's just...
there's no substitute for combat.
There's no substitute for combat. And you never know... See, that was one of the things when we first got over there, everyone was considered a cherry. Mm-hmm. Until you got fired at. That's the mentality of being in combat, in a war. Well, they call it a conflict, but anybody that you talk to, I mean, it was a war. There's no conflict. They can say whatever they want. Someone's shooting at you, and you're shooting back, it's a war. You know, politicians can call whatever they want, but when you're over there in the trenches, I mean, look how long that thing lasted. That was a conflict. I mean, that was their civil war.
Yes.
We shouldn't even have been there, in my opinion.
Okay.
You know.
Well, you raise an interesting question. What did you understand was your purpose behind being in Vietnam? I mean...
Well, my
Yeah, where did you fit into the
perspective
big picture?
Was that...
And what was the big picture?
We were trying to keep democracy alive for the South Vietnamese. See, during when the French were there, they went through the same thing, and that's when they split it into North and South Vietnam. And a lot of the ones that weren't into communism migrated to the South. And they had the thing with Buddhists and Catholics, because the ruling regime was Catholic, which was a minority in that Buddhist country. And so a small minority was actually in control of a majority. Mm-hmm. So there's problems with that, and they were corrupt as hell. The government was corrupt. I mean, they weren't easy. The Vietnamese were, I don't know how to put it, they were just, it was take, take, take. Mm-hmm. You know, just take, take, take. And you couldn't count on them. We worked with them quite a bit, and they were cowards. They weren't into going out and fighting. I couldn't understand it. Here we are, here trying to help these people. They don't even want to help themselves. So I had a problem with that. I'm getting off the track with this. Where were we?
Well, just the whole issue of what we were trying to accomplish in Vietnam, as you understood it.
We were trying. Yeah, it's, you know, that's what's hard sometimes. You think about this stuff and you know the answer, and then all of a sudden there ain't nothing there. Basically, we were there trying to help them have a democracy, free elections, just like we do in America. Be a democracy. We were fighting the communists who were trying to... overthrow their government. So basically, that's what I figured we were doing, was trying to help these people help themselves. And then in the end, all they cared about was money and greed, people in power, and the people themselves didn't want to... I mean, they didn't want to they didn't want to fight. What the hell are we doing there? I'm thinking.
Well, let's talk about your first experiences in Vietnam. You arrived June of 1967.
Yes.
First place of entry was Ben Hoa Air Base.
Yeah, we landed in Ben Hoa.
And stayed there for about, I'll go ahead and pause this.
It helped them help themselves, you know, basically what my feelings were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the political part of it, you know, that, you know, once you're over there, it didn't matter what the politics were, you're just trying to stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
And make it through your, you know, I never thought in my life that I would count the days off in a year. Mm-hmm. You had a calendar. You start from 365 until you got to 30, then you're a short timer.
Mm-hmm.
And the only time in my life I ever watched the calendar that closely.
Did everybody else do it too?
Everybody. Everyone had a short timer calendar. The ones we had was a naked woman,
mm-hmm.
that was, you know, squared off into 365 squares. Had the nipples and the mm-hmm. pussy on there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that, you know, well, to be honest with you, what we were over there fighting for was the women.
Mm-hmm.
To get back to the U.S., round-eyed women.
Mm-hmm.
The longer you were over there, the rounder the eyes got of the Vietnamese. You know, and at that age, you walk around, you got a fucking hard on all the time. 20 years old, like you walk around with a Woody all the time. And, you know, and you're at the age that you're just sexually active.
Yeah.
And I had a friend of mine that was a medic, so I had him, I was either getting rubbers or whatever, but he turned me on to tetracycline. He gave me a big jar of tetracycline. He said, eat one of these a day. And you won't have to worry about getting gonorrhea or anything from the prostitutes.
Hmm.
So I was lucky that way. Some guys did get, I think one guy in our unit got that incurable VD.
Oh, man.
Yeah, because, you know, it was rumors that these people never got sent back to the States that picked up this incurable shit they had over there.
Yeah.
They were shipped off to some other place and they were listed as missing or... Now, this is just a rumor, but this was going on while we were in country.
Because
it was happening. There was, you know, I mean, every time, like, especially with aviation guys, whenever we shut down anywhere on standby or something, Mama-san would be out there selling her daughter or some little kid would be selling her sister. So you called it Boom Boom.
Mm-hmm.
That's what pussy was called over there. Mm-hmm. So you want number one, Boom Boom. Cherry girl, you know, like a virgin, they call them cherry girls. But, you know, they were small. No hair down here. Did a lot of fucking over there, too. I mean, besides the war, they were pretty lenient about that, the commanders, because they know that you had to take care of that. I mean, if you're out there fighting every day, they got to give you some time to vent.
Yes.
You know.
I just never heard it referred to that, but that way before, the way you described it just now.
Yeah, that's
the way of putting it. The longer you were in country, the rounder the eyes got.
That's right.
Okay. I want to get into some of the policies that your units had with regard to your interaction with Vietnamese, but before we get to that point, when you first got assigned to the 188th, you spent about 10 days at the 90th replacement, Long Bin, and you got assigned to the 188th, the Black Widows.
At Dao Chiang. It was called, actually, Dao Chiang was...
Oh, yeah, this is at Dao Chiang.
Dao Chiang. It was, the name of Dao Chiang was Camp Rainier, like Rainier Mountain,
mm-hmm.
because the 4th Infantry Division, that was it was the 3rd Brigade base camp, 3rd Brigade of 4th Infantry Division. They came from Fort Lewis, Washington, so that's how the name came about.
Makes sense.
And, of course, I took basic up there. It was up in Washington, so I mean, Mount Rainier is right there.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful.
Black Widows and Spiders were the call signs. Black Widows being the true carriers and Spiders being the gunships.
Yep.
Okay. And your primary duty at first was base security, perimeter defense.
Perimeter guard.
Yeah, perimeter guard. How long did you do that?
30 days.
And then you moved up from that to a door gunner?
Right. But the reason why is, see, during that time in May of 67, see, the original unit came from Fort Campbell. Mm-hmm. All the door gunners were airborne volunteers to fly. Mm-hmm. They were airborne rated. Mm-hmm. So once the unit got to Vietnam, the 173rd was getting their ass kicked up at Dock Tho. Mm-hmm. And there was other airborne units that were taking heavy casualties in May of 67. Mm-hmm. So what they did, the military command in Vietnam came down with a directive saying anybody that was airborne rated was going to be transferred into these units to bring them back to strength. Mm-hmm. So the door gunners in our unit were confronted. They either had to drop their airborne status or they're going to get shipped out. So I think about 12 guys from our unit were shipped out. They didn't want to drop their, you know, they were macho. If you were airborne, you were something, you know. Yeah. I didn't want to jump out of a plane, you know what I mean? I don't need that kind of excitement. But anyway, these guys thought it was a cool thing to do.
Yeah.
So when they shipped these guys out, then they had 9 slots open on the helicopters. Mm-hmm. And we had an infantry MOS, so we were given flight physicals. Mm-hmm. We passed the flight physical, and they changed our MOS to 11B2F, okay, which was aerial gunner. Mm-hmm. And I got put in 2nd platoon. That's when I met John, the guy that next door here, and then all the guys in 2nd platoon. And, any company, everybody had a little clique that they hung with. Yep. That's the way life is, basically. Yep. So if you're in 2nd platoon, that was your life. Those are the guys you hung out with. There was 10 helicopters for each platoon, slicks, HMOS. See, we're the first unit to arrive in Vietnam with the Bell UH-1H helicopter. That was the new model out on the market. Mm-hmm. And we arrived in country. It had more power than the other mm-hmm. previous models. So we ended up getting all these special operations because we had the strongest bird and power. So that's how we got involved with a lot of special forces stuff. And we had, and same with our gunships. We had the new Charlie model, which was, you know, this was just before the Cobra. You know, it's like the transition of aircraft.
What were your first impressions of the Black Widows, the 188? Was this, you mentioned the FNG mentality. You went as the cherry.
We arrive at the unit. Yeah. These fucking guys, all trained at Fort Campbell together, they came over intact as a unit. Mm-hmm. And people wouldn't talk to you much. You're usually stuck with the guys that you come into the unit with. Mm-hmm. It was a feeling like you didn't really want to get to know anybody real close because they might get killed. Because mm-hmm. Aviation, you're right out there, we were their ride to the battle and back. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd bring ammo in when they run out of ammo, you know, and this right during the firefight, so we were under heavy enemy fire a lot of the time. But, you know, we all thought we were bulletproof. That was our mentality. Yeah, 20, 21 years old, you know, we had no fear. I mean, we did have fear, don't get me wrong, but you had to put that fear back in the closet when you're out there on these missions, mm-hmm. or you couldn't maintain. And you had to maintain under fire, otherwise you had 3 other guys that were counting on you on the helicopter. And until you proved yourself under fire, you wouldn't get any respect from anybody. Once you were in a firefight, you noticed more people would be talking to you because they know that you'd proved yourself under fire and they could count on you. Strange, but that's the way it looked to me.
Now, what units did you primarily support when you were the troop carriers? Was it, you used to mention special ops guys, so the
okay,
special
well,
forces and SOG.
Okay, well, down south, our primary, see, our battalion, the 269th, was stationed at Coochee.
Uh-huh.
We had three assault helicopter companies, and we supported the 25th Division, which had three brigades. Mm-hmm. So it worked out to where the 188th supported the 3rd Brigade at Daojiang.
Mm-hmm.
The 187th Assault Helicopter Company supported the 2nd Brigade at Tainin. And the 1st Brigade was at Kuchi, supported by the 116th, was our Assault Helicopter Company. They were our sister companies in the
mm-hmm.
battalion.
Okay.
So our primary support was the 25th Infantry Division. But we did support the 9th Infantry Division.
Mm-hmm.
We did. We worked several operations with them.
Mm-hmm.
The 199th Light Infantry Brigade, we worked with them, and we worked with the 1st Infantry Division. Those units worked in, their AO area of operation was Western 3rd Corps.
Mm-hmm.
So you worked with all the units that were in the area. It wasn't,
mm-hmm.
but like I said, our basic focus was the 3rd Brigade of the 25th Division, which was the 2nd of the 12th Infantry, the 3rd of the 22nd Infantry, the 2nd of the 22nd Triple Deuce was a mech outfit. Those were the three companies within the 3rd Brigade.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a lot of work with those guys.
Okay. Now the... What about Arvin units?
Oh, we worked with the 25th Arvin Division. You'll like this one. The 25th Arvin Division was a joke. Their commanding officer, come to find out a couple years after we left, was a communist spy. He was a mole.
Mm-hmm.
But he was the 25th Arvin Division commander. We always wondered why whenever we went out on operations that we never made contact. And I know now because I found out. But they were a joke. We used to have to push them out of the helicopter. They wouldn't get out of the chopper. See, the Arvins were so small, like a regular payload on a slick, you'd put 6 infantry guys in there.
Mm-hmm.
Plus 4 would be 10 guys on that chopper. You'd have a full load.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with Vietnamese, we could get 10 of those guys in there. And we'd come in, we'd be on a combat assault, we'd fly in, prep the area, you know, do all the above, airstrikes, artillery. They knew we were coming, but they weren't there. They'd been warned and they were out of the area. So we never got into any shit with working with them. They were a pathetic division. I come to find out that the ranking officer that took over for this guy, that they took him to jail,
mm-hmm.
you know, this mole,
mm-hmm.
He turned the division around to be one of the best in the country after we left. But during that time frame, that's where the Arvins were at. We hated working with them.
Now, you said you had to kick them off.
We'd be, like say, when we first got over there, it was the monsoon season, so water everywhere.
Yeah.
So we didn't want it. You didn't want to land in it because your skids would stick down into the mud and you might not get back up.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd hover above the rice.
Yeah.
And they're supposed to jump out. Well, some of them didn't want to get off the ship. So I had to physically throw these Arvins off the ship. Me or the crew chief, if they're on his side, he'd have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And you always had to watch them because there was VC in their ranks and they were known, we were told that these guys would turn around or leave a grenade, pull the pin, leave the grenade in the ship up under the seats in the cargo bay. And if you didn't look for it, you know, shame on you. But if someone didn't tell you that ahead of time, you wouldn't know that this might happen. So the guys would that had the experience would give you little pointers. I mean, should give you the pointers that, you know, watch when these guys get off. And yet we had to watch them to make sure they didn't turn around and fire on us. Because there was VC in their ranks.
Mm-hmm. Were there incidents in your unit when that happened?
No. Not that I recall. But it was kind of a weird feeling to think, you know, we're fighting with these guys, and you got to worry about them leaving a full grenade in the ship or turn around and fire on you. No, didn't like working with the Arvins. We did work with them quite a bit.
Was there ever any incidents where you had to rapidly get out of an area where you were working with Arvins because it became a hot LZ? Or did you always go into cold LZs with them?
With the 25th Division, yeah.
It was always cold?
Yeah. This guy, this mole, would contact, when he found out what the operation was about, mm-hmm. he'd get in touch with his counterpart.
American, you took in from the 25th ID or the 9th ID.
Oh, we got into shit. We got into shit.
But whenever you were taking Arvin around,
yeah.
you'd go into cold LZs.
Cold LZs. And they probably wouldn't even... Oh, shit. They would stay in the LZ. These guys wouldn't even go out on sweeps and that. That's how aggressive they were. They weren't aggressive at all. That's the word I was trying to find earlier. Was,
okay.
You know, they didn't really care about fighting. And this was their war. So I didn't see the point why we should be over there getting killed, and these guys don't even really care.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, basically, you know, they're just, most of the Vietnamese, all they want to do is farm their land.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't about politics. Don't feed the kids, just life.
Mm-hmm.
But then you had the communists wanting to take over, and, you know, the politics comes into it. And from what I saw, that's basically my interpretation, was that they just wanted to be left alone to fish, to do what they do, and you know.
Did you and your other soldiers, did you talk to other people about this kind of stuff? Like, for instance, with the Arvin, and here you got to kick them off the helicopters. They don't seem to be very willing to fight. What the hell are we here for? Did you guys talk about that kind of stuff?
All the time. I tell you, when we got in after flying, we'd end up we'd end up over at the M Club, or we might go out by the berm, smoke a joint, you know, unwind. Some guys didn't like alcohol, so they'd smoke weed.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you didn't have to deal with a hangover in the morning when you got up. You're mm-hmm. just smoking weed.
Mm-hmm.
But we'd talk about, it would be like a group session. You know, once the flights came in, you might come in at different times and stuff, but you'd end up over at the M Club, drinking beer, talking about the day's missions. What happened, who got shot at. I mean, you had to vent,
mm-hmm.
and that's how we did it.
Yeah.
We got together as, even if it was just in the second platoon hooch. See, our whole time in country, we lived in tents. We didn't have any sea huts or permanent structures. We lived pretty basic. Like I said, we were in isolated areas our whole time. You know, we made do where we didn't have the stuff a lot of the other aviation units had. They were in more secure areas.
Mm-hmm.
But thank God we're aviation. We could fly and get whatever we needed. See, we're lucky that way.
Yeah.
Just send a bird down to Saigon, pick up a case of beer, go get liquor. Made sure there was plenty of liquor in the company.
Mm-hmm.
They had two clubs, EM and, well, they had EM Club and NCO Club and Officers Club. We had a theater. They showed movies. Like I said, we had the swimming pool there at Dao Chang. They had a snack bar, the only snack bar in War Zone C. Sold hot dogs and hamburgers and shakes. I mean, it was unbelievable. And we were lucky because our company area was real close to the pool and that. I mean, it's hard to... You know, you trip on it, you think, God, in the middle of a war zone here, these guys are out hanging at the swimming pool, and it was neat. There was three pools there, and there was two others that, see, the French caretaker that took care of the plantation trees, he had two pools, but those were for the officers. Unless the guys could only go over to this other pool. And this guy used to come in once a week to collect money from the military. See, if we put any gouges in those rubber trees, they would leach Playtex or the rubber. So we had to pay them so much money for holes or damage to the trees. And they had something going with the VC too, because they were in production during the war, the French. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of funny, here we are in the middle of the war zone, they're worried about us putting a fucking hole in their tree. You know, bullets flying in, and we had a lot of, took a lot of sniper fire there. We usually you'd have formations in the morning, but we wouldn't have them there at Dow Chang because the snipers could hit us in our company area from the village. The village was just across the road from us. I mean, it was, you could throw a stone from our perimeter into the village. It was that close. The road actually came real within a few feet of that. See, here's our perimeter. Just give you an idea.
Okay.
This is a cleared area. We had 55-gallon drums of foos gas, and this was all concertina wire, but right around here where it come around, that's how close the village was to our perimeter. There'd be a bunker, like, right here.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, this is all VC-controlled village, this whole area was. They were digging tunnels into the base camp while we were there. Matter of fact, we had gotten mortar during one of the mortar attacks.
Mm-hmm.
One of the tunnels collapsed, and that's how we found out that they were digging tunnels into the base camp.
Wow.
Now, they never got into the base camp during our tenure there, but later on in 68 or early 60, I think it was 69, they came in, they dug the tunnel into one of the, into the plantation manager's home.
Mm-hmm.
They got up into the mansion, and that's how they attacked from inside, and they killed all the people in the building. I learned this because I contacted some guys from, okay. I've made contact with all the infantry units we supported, so I got their feedback, kind of like what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And they did get into the base camp, but like I said, never when, they didn't use them while we were there.
Mm-hmm.
And we left in March of 68, and about a year later, they used those tunnels to attack the base camp. And this was the gate, this was the main street going into Dao Chang.
Mm-hmm.
Just give you a little perspective on what we're talking about.
Thanks. Now, the villagers themselves, would they come up and try to sell things to
them?
Oh,
yeah.
What were the rules about interacting with them? You said that
the rules. Well, see, basically they had MPs, that was their job, was to maintain traffic around a base camp.
Mm-hmm.
Control the workers. Like, we had indigenous workers working in the company area. There was, I think we had 17. One of them was the mayor of Dao Chang. He was in charge of these 17. We had two laundries in our company area that were Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
The barber that used to cut my hair and shave me with a straight edge, they killed him on one night trying to get through the wire. He was a VC, but he was our company barber. He was killed in the wire, trying to get in, with some satchel charges or whatever. He's going to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And the mayor of Dao Chang, it caught him stepping off the distance between our helicopter revetments at the airfield. They arrested him and took him away. Now, these are people that we're bringing onto the base. And they're VC.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have the problems at LZ Sally that we did at Dao Chang, because up there the 101st had a directive that there would be no Vietnamese workers in any of the base camps.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm trying to say is we didn't get mortared as much at Sally as we did at Dao Chang, because they had all the set. They had plotted everything down there.
Mm-hmm. They had plotted everything down there.
Yeah, they had the distances down, so they'd give this information to the mortar crew that was out in the Razorback Mountains. There's a small rise of mountains just north of the base camp.
Mm-hmm.
They'd have spotters up there, and they would just start punching mortars. See, they wanted to go after the helicopters.
Yeah.
That was their main thing. Fuck the infantry. They want to get the helicopters. So they'd mortar the airfield, and they would adjust their fire. The guy would, a spotter. They'd either have a spotter in the village here, up in a high building or a tree, seeing where the rounds were hitting, mm-hmm. and they would adjust. You know, they'd have radios too. And we got mortared a lot there. Rocketed and mortared. We used to call it Mortar City. Rocket City. I talked to the guys that were there after we left, and they told me that they called it Rocket City. But we got mortared a lot there, especially during, right before Tet. Mm-hmm. See, this was the Saigon River ran right along here. This is the Saigon River right here. And that was their major infiltration route coming in from Cambodia. This area was a staging area for the VC units. So they popped us down right in the middle of all this shit. So we were completely isolated out there. A lot of rubber plantations in Third Corps. Mm-hmm. Michelin was, I never bought Michelin tires in my life. This was a Michelin plantation. Mm-hmm. I wrote to Michelin in France trying to get some background on their operations during the 20s there, and they didn't even respond to it. Those people really didn't have a choice when the communists came in and tried to get their support, because the French were brutally treating them. They were actually killing these people. They were slaves. If I was one of these Vietnamese that was working on these plantations for the French, I would have turned into being a communist. That was their only... I can understand why they embraced communism. I mean, when you're being brutally beaten and they didn't pay them much, I researched it. There's some books that were written or were translated from Vietnamese about those times from the 20s. So, I know I got off the beaten
track.
No. With that understanding, I didn't realize this till later, yeah. later in my life, but at the time, I had no idea that, we were always leery being around the Vietnamese because we didn't know speak the language. You'd hear them talking, mm-hmm. and you didn't, you know yourself, if you don't understand what they're saying, you don't, what are they saying?
For the barber, he might be talking about how he's going to kill you.
Yeah, so like I said, the barber that used to shave us with a straight, they used a straight razor, was a Viet Cong, and like I said, he was killed one night trying to get into the base camp.
Yeah. Now, how frequently was the base camp rocketed or mortared while you were there? Are you talking about on a weekly basis, a daily basis, or
daily?
Wow.
Night at nighttime. Well, we used to fire off during the day too.
Many casualties as a result of that stuff?
Well, on the June 24th, 67, the flight, they'd been working 9th Infantry Division down by Na Bay, Tan An area. They got back. I was pulling security guard that time. I was out on the perimeter that night. And they came in. Standing orders from battalion was that our aircraft were supposed to be dispersed throughout the area, not all kept in one spot at the airfield. So the CO said, fuck it. He was tired or whatever. He wasn't going to disperse the aircraft. They needed maintenance pulled on them and some other stuff. So he disregarded this order. And about 11:02 that evening, we got hit with a 100-round mortar barrage, and it took out 29 of our 31 helicopters in a matter of minutes. We were non-operational by 11:30 that night. Like I said, two of our gunships got up. They did get out and take out the mortar tubes that were firing on us, but the next morning there was 29 helicopters that were damaged.
How severely damaged?
I think they fixed 11 of them. Shrapnel damage. Three of the gunships were completely destroyed. One of the gunships that was on counter mortar was actually cranking when a mortar round hit the tail boom, mm-hmm. landed on the chopper and destroyed it. So these guys, you think they're excited. They jump off this chopper and go to another gunship. They're trying to get up, mm-hmm. while all these fucking mortars are raining in, 82-millimeter mortars. Now, in the meantime, when this mortar attack hit, you got to understand, all the ships, there was maintenance guys out there working on all these ships, you know, for whatever reason, you know. And so there was between 25 and 30 guys were wounded during that mortar attack. No one got killed. We lucked out that way. Now I'm on the perimeter. I'm blown. I'm waiting for a human wave attack to come now. After the mortar attack, usually there's a ground attack. That didn't come, thank God. So, yeah, I remember going up to the airfield in the morning, and there was dud rounds laying in the PCP. You know, that was a steel planking they put over the ground so you wouldn't sink in the mud. There was expended rounds rounds that didn't go off that were stuck, you know, that penetrated the steel, but it was just there with the fin on it from the mortar round. Mm-hmm. And the ships were just, you know, they were just devastated. There was shrapnel all over. I got pictures of them. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I have them with me here. This is our mascot, Second Platoon mascot.
Oh, no.
We call him Fucker Six. It was a little take on the seal. We had a French twist to it. It was Fuck Yeah, but it was actually Fucker Six. See, here's one of the other. No, here's some of the shrapnel right here.
Okay.
See the last mat?
Yeah. Peppered.
And this was one of my hooch mains here. So this is just, some were minor damage, but it still all had to be fixed.
Yeah.
I mean, you couldn't fly them until you fixed those holes.
Right.
And that was one of the first nose arts we had. When the unit got in country, I think we had three different nose arts. This is up at Katoom. This is look at the area. This is the area we worked. Desolate. This is over by the Cambodian border. So if you went down out in that jungle, you wouldn't see. They really didn't tell us all the time where to go if we went down, which way to go, or you know, the communication wasn't all that good.
You mean if you were shot down?
If we're shot down, they say, you know, if we get shot down today, head this way.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, give you some kind of idea. Where's the good guys at? And, you know, instead of being wandering around. I mean, what was good about aviation, if you went down, your wingman was coming down and get you. Mm-hmm. So we were lucky that way. So we didn't get, actually, we didn't have any missing in action in our unit per se. When we moved north, our sister company had, I think, two guys missing in action during one of the operations that they never did find them. We did have a missing in action with the Black Widows later on during C-101. They presumed that he got killed. The medic checked him. He got shot in the neck, and he was dead, but they didn't retrieve the body. And then when they finally went back in to get him, mm-hmm. body was gone. So they had to carry him as MIA.
Yeah.
His name's on the flag. We'll be doing that down at the wall on Monday.
Okay. Now, were there any other incidents similar to the one where you lost the 29 out of 31 helicopters?
Nothing came close to that mortar attack. I mean, as far as damaging our helicopters, we lost plenty of birds on missions.
Yeah.
From ground fire.
Yeah. Well, why don't we talk about some of them then?
Okay.
What was your first experience under fire?
My first experience under fire was August 30th, 1967. It was actually my baptism of fire in the unit when I finally got on as a door gunner. We were Chalk 9. VC tactics were that they would let the main body of the flight land in the LZ and would open up on the last two aircraft in the flight, hoping that they would crash into the planes, Hueys on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So we were Chalk 9. We were working with 4th of the 9th Manchus. They were 2nd Brigade. I think it was 2nd Brigade. Whatever, 25th Division.
Mm-hmm.
And what it was supposed to be a bomb damage assessment mission. They didn't wear any of their gear, just weapons and ammo pack and canteens. Just supposed to be a walk in the park.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we're told. It was in the Iron Triangle at a place called the Horseshoe. They call it the Horseshoe because from the air it looked like a horseshoe, the bend in the Saigon River. For 2 days, they had the Goleman Battalion was a local Forest BC battalion, one of the best units that we fought against in that area, was supposedly in this horseshoe area. They hit it with B-52 strikes for 2 days, artillery, air strikes, and we were going to bring the Manchus in for a bomb damage assessment. When we flew in, we weren't on the first flight, we were on the second flight. They had three lifts that went in, 10 helicopters at a time flying into the LZ. The first bunch that flew in, they opened up on, and they damaged 9 out of 10 aircraft. The only Huey that didn't get fired on was the lead aircraft. For whatever reason, they had set up a 7-point ambush for us when we came in. So that flight, they dropped those guys off, they took off, they got the shit shot out of them, and we, for some reason, our ship was down, the PZ was Coochie, and we had some kind of minor problem with the helicopter, so we weren't on the first flight, we went in with the second flight. Same thing happened on the second flight, and plus they had all these grunts pinned on the ground, they're out in the middle of these rice paddies, and they were all around that circle. Like I said, it was a 7-point ambush. Mm-hmm. So they had 7 positions, and that was the ambush. Mm-hmm. So when we flew in on the second flight, we were chalk 9. And we're about 20 feet off the ground, and all hell breaks loose. That first thing I know, his true blood gets blown out of his, where he was, and behind his gun on the left side. We were receiving fire on the left side, so I didn't see shit because I'm on the right side. Mm-hmm. All I know is I'm hearing the rounds going through the helicopter, hit one of the infantry guys up in the front. There were 6 of them. These guys dove out of the helicopter at about 20 feet up. Wow. They were out. They were gone. True Blood got shot in the arm and got blown into the cargo bay. And at this time, I'm freaking, you know, I'm telling the pilot, you know, it's fucking True Blood's hit. I left my 60 to go over. Okay, I left my 60 to go administer first aid to Drew, but I left my weapon. Okay, so I left my weapon, my 60, grabbed the first aid kit, started giving Jim, fixing his wound up. So right after this happened, just a few seconds later, another burst of AK fire came through where he was sitting, through the transmission housing, mm-hmm. and would have killed me, because I was on the right behind him. Mm-hmm. But because I was left my position to help Jim, his getting wounded saved my life. Mm-hmm. So we're on the ground, and fire is just coming from, you know, we're getting all our fire from the left side. We don't know nothing about the helicopters on the ground in front of us. And they won't let you take off. They want you to leave in a fucking formation. You're under fire now, and, you know, and I'm freaking on the radio. I'm telling the pilot, let's get the fuck out of here. Mm-hmm. You know, like they don't know we're receiving fire. You know, this one of the infantry guys got wounded that was in the ship on Jim's side, mm-hmm. and plus Jim got wounded. And so we finally got out of there, took him back to Coochie. He was my bunkmate. We spent some time together. Mm-hmm. We hooked up at the reunion at Fort Worth for the first time in 30 years. Wow. He lives up in Alaska now, but every August 30th we call each other. I mean, that's something that will be with us the rest of our life. Yeah. That was the heaviest encounter that we were in as a unit. It was actually, I'm not saying it was the heaviest. I mean, we saw a lot of stuff along those lines. Mm-hmm. Because, like I said, we had the new model, H model, and so we got more dangerous missions. Mm-hmm. Then we got back, we took Jim back to the Coochie, dropped him off at the hospital, and then went back I think the third flight they wouldn't even bring in there because our choppers were so shot up.
Did you lose any?
We didn't lose any in the LZ. We all got out, but I mean, there was damage to our birds from the rounds that we took.
Yeah. And what about the guys you dropped off? I mean, they went in, as you said, for a cakewalk for a BDA, but they went into a hot LZ with a lot of enemy around there.
Yeah.
Did they get pulled out by you guys or somebody else?
Somebody else. Matter of fact, later in the day, when they were running out of ammo, one of the crews volunteered. They asked for volunteers to go in with an ammo resupply.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be voluntary because they were pinned down. Mm-hmm. You know, you've been flying. What a target.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So two of the guys did, who was it, Spearman, Marquez, Sandy, and this, is it Williams? I think of the name of the dork, because he got killed on the fucking mission. Anyway, they volunteered to do this. It was late in the day. Mm-hmm. These guys were running out of ammo, so, and plus they had a bunch of wounded. They had a bunch of guys killed in the LZ.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a bunch of bodies down there, too.
Okay.
And so they volunteered for this mission, so they flew in. They picked up, they unloaded the ammo. Now, it was probably high tide, too. It's a water table, third course, high tide. The water was always high up in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
So they're hovering up above the paddy. They unloaded the ammo. They're taking all kinds of fire. During this time, the guy got hit. The door gunner got hit, took a round. He had his chicken plate on, but he got the round in through here.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought he was okay. He told Mark that he was okay. He didn't realize, he's probably so scared he didn't realize that the severity of the wound.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, he got killed. And during this time, the ground commander's on the radio trying to get our guys to get their wounded out of there. So these guys are hovering above the rice paddy, taking fire from all around. They hovered over to the other side to pick up the wounded. They were actually floating them out on the water on air mattresses to keep these guys, from drowning. I mean, they're wounded.
Mm-hmm.
And as Bill was loading up one of the guys, he got shot in the ass. Now, two of the guys got silver stars for this. Spearman and Bill Sandy got silver stars for volunteering for this mission.
Mm-hmm.
Marquez had problems for years. He wasn't put in for any kind of medal, and he should have been.
Mm-hmm.
He volunteered his volunteering mission. Of course, and then the other guy got killed. I'm sure he didn't get a fucking medal or anything. He got a Purple Heart.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how that's how this particular mission ended for our unit. As far as picking them up, I don't know who picked them up.
Yeah.
But it was, that story's going into history.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big chapter in the history. Other missions, we worked with B-36, Bo Gritz,
mm-hmm.
legendary special forces guy. At this time, he was a captain. He was a ball buster, he was, let's go kill him. We worked with those guys on Operation Rapid Fire 5.
Mm-hmm.
Staged out of Tainan East.
What was the purpose of this operation, Rapid Fire?
Reconnaissance, POW snatches for intelligence purposes. For Special Forces, was an intelligence branch for Second Field Force, which was the main on the chain of command. They were at the top,
mm-hmm.
for Third Corps. And for intelligence purposes, information. Always tried to get, they did snatch a few POWs, and there was a red Chinese nurse that they did snatch on that operation. That she was shot up, though, and died on the way back from one of the missions. We had trouble getting them in and out. It was over by the Cambodian border. I think that at that time, this was like the end of December, so I think it was, the intelligence was for, had to do with Operation Yellowstone. That was the big operation we were on at the time. Mm-hmm. So it was, they're trying to get some information, just, you know, get some POWs. They wanted to snatch them to get information for interrogation. And it was, we were doing one-ship insertions, false insertions, so that the enemy wouldn't know for sure if we dropped troops off or not. Mm-hmm. These were tactics that were just beginning to be used, that were used later. Mm-hmm. That was one thing, like when you're fighting in a war, whatever you learn today, you know if you fucked up, you ain't going to use it tomorrow. Yeah. So that's how you learned as you went. Lessons learned, that's what they call these things.
Yeah.
Operational reports, lessons learned, so that it wouldn't happen again. So mm-hmm. it's all trial and error, I mean, the whole way through. You learned as you went. I mean, if you did something wrong, you knew the next day that you wouldn't do that again.
Mm-hmm.
Especially under fire. I mean, that was the deal. You'd be under fire. Because Frank wants to do this too, so I told you.
Okay. You mentioned both Greitz's unit. What about other SOG units or Special Forces units?
Well, we worked with B-36. That was teams A-361 and 362. Mm-hmm. Those were 2A teams. We also worked with the Koreans up in. After our helicopters got fucking blown up, mm-hmm. We were given a direct order by Lieutenant Colonel Jim Merriman, was a 269th Battalion commanding officer. And he gave, needless to say, the next day our commanding officer was relieved of duty after the mortar attack.
Mm.
They came down from 1st Aviation Brigade. These are $500,000 items that were flying around.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was 1st Aviation Brigade, 269th Commanding Officer Merriman came down, and our CO and XO, and I think the gun platoon leader were relieved of duty on the spot and taken out of the unit right off. So we got a new CO after that. Our unit had, the 188th had four different commanding officers during our time frame.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Johnson was the third. And when he gave over command to Hank Dreher, and then he became the last 188th CO and the first C Company 101st Aviation Battalion Black Widows CO. Hank and Jack were the only two of the four commanding officers that would help me with the history. The other two didn't have anything to do with it. Well, Wolford, I could understand he was relieved of duty, but you know, from a historic standpoint, I don't give a shit about what happened. I'm just trying to write a story, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he just recently died, our first CO. In January he died. McWhorter was a dickhead. He was a West Pointer.
Mm-hmm.
A real dickhead. Him and Top, they went back and forth. Now, our first sergeant lives in Williamsburg. We're going down there tomorrow for a barbecue.
Mm-hmm.
So you won't see us over there tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
He stuck up for his guys. Now, this is a black man in a white man's army in 1967. There was death threats on his life. There's a lot of Southerners and Southern boys in our unit.
Mm-hmm.
And the Southerns still fight the Civil War. You know, they don't like niggers, as they would put it.
Mm-hmm.
And Top had death threats on his life in the unit. So he was real jumpy. He didn't like people walking up on him from behind.
Mm-hmm.
He was always packing. He even had a formation out, even besides the sniper fire, he had a formation, everybody out in front of the orderly room. He carried pearl handled 44 Magnum pistol, Western style, had two holsters set up. And he got everybody out in formation, took out one of the 44s and put a couple rounds in one of the rubber trees. And he told everybody that if you're out to get me, you better watch your fucking back because I'm going to blow your brains out. This guy was, he retired out of Nam. He'd spent 2 years in Korea. This guy was combat savvy and he was a good man. But for But because he was black, there was a lot of guys in the unit that would not accept him as their first sergeant. And then the death threats, the rumors started going around. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it took, even years later, when I first found Tom, he couldn't believe that, you want to write about our fucking history in Nam. So this is where it started, and finally, now he's with me.
Okay.
But at the beginning, he had those memories of someone trying to kill him in the unit, and he's, mm-hmm. that's where he was coming from. And
oh, yeah.
So there was some stuff going on besides the war that, you know, made life a little uneasy at times within the company.
Were there any incidents of fragging in your unit?
Yes. Matter of fact, there was. When we moved up north to LZ Sally, we had a problem child. It was a black guy from, he was from Chicago. Anyway, he was having problems with his wife at home. He had problems when he was drinking. This other guy would appear, this real angry individual, you know. We always refer to it as the other guy. You know, when you wake up in the morning, you'd be back to yourself, but if you drank too much, you turn into the other guy. Mm-hmm. So he had confronted a few people at Dao Chiang with a loaded M16 and threatened to kill him. He thought the one guy, well, this Richard Kaplan was the mailroom. That was his job. That would have been a good job for anybody if you're in the unit, be the mailroom guy. So that's all you dealt with, was the mail. So anyway, this guy wasn't getting any letters from home, and he thought this is how fucked up he was when he got drunk. He was thinking that this guy was holding his mail out and not giving it to him. So they had a big confrontation in the mess hall. He pulled a weapon. He was threatening these guys with a loaded M16. Now this happened on two or three occasions. The MPs showed up, took him away for a few days. He came back to the unit. He'd been busted down a couple of times. He had some head problems. All this was behind his drinking. I think if they had kept him off the booze, none of this stuff would have transpired. But anyway, nothing was changed. So these problems, when you got four different commanding officers coming and going during your tour, they don't know the history behind maybe one individual in the unit. So they come in blind. They don't know that this guy's a walking time bomb, yep, ready to go up. So we moved up north. They took him off flight status after these incidents down south. They put him in the 603rd, which was our maintenance detachment. And then I think after these two altercations down at Dao Chiang, then they took him out of the 603rd and ended up putting him in the motor pool. Busted him down to private. Mm-hmm. He was a Spec 5 or something. So his cash flow is really deleted now. I mean, we ain't making much to begin with, but now they got him way down here. Mm-hmm. So we get up to Sally. We're out flying. All the flights are out. All the crews are out on a mission. It was during the day. This guy had been drinking in the morning. First sergeant after the palm was a guy called Pearl Ackley. Now, isn't that a handle, Pearl? Mm-hmm. I tried to locate him, couldn't find him. But anyway, he was first sergeant. He had a duty formation. Then he would delegate, you know, details to whoever. So they're doing a police call through the area, and here's McKeever sitting in one of the tents. During a duty day, you're not in your tent. You're out doing something. You can't be in your bunk. So they had a confrontation in the room. Now, the 603rd, or I think at the time he was still in the 603rd, they had their own first sergeant. 188th had their own first sergeant. So this Pearl Ackley is getting on this guy's shit, and he's, you know, he's half in the bag drunk. So he's saying, well, fuck you. I don't want to talk to you. I want to talk to my first sergeant. I ain't got nothing to say to you. So he told him, okay, done. Take you over to the orderly room. Took him over to the orderly room, told him to stay there while he went to find the other first sergeant. So he takes off. So McKeever decides, hey, fuck, The first sergeant tells us, Mike Vickroy, he's the company clerk, to watch this guy. Mm-hmm. If he goes to the bathroom, go with him, make sure you know where he is. So as soon as he's gone, McKeever gets up and he heads out for the bunker lane. So Vickroy, you don't want no part of this, you know, I mean. So, I mean, he was happy to see the guy take off. So anyway, he goes down the bunker line, and my good friend Dan Woolley's down. He's sergeant of the guard. He's a duty sergeant that day for the perimeter guard. So he's down there, and McKeever goes down, and he gets the M16 and grabs a couple of grenades out of one of the bunkers. And he threatened, he threatened everybody on the perimeter that he was going to kill them if they came close to him. So what he ends up doing is, he put a grenade in his pocket, in his fatigue pocket, and he fainted like he was going to go turn himself in to the first sergeant. He gave the M16 to Danny. Danny cleared the weapon. It was loaded. And he threw a couple grenades up on the bunker. We had boxes full of grenades for the perimeter, right? Mm-hmm. So these guys thought it was over with, that he had given all his stuff back, but they didn't know that he still had a grenade in his fatigue jacket. So he's going on. He's really pissed off now. He's uptight with anybody with authority is not the person that you would want to be a captain or something running as McKeever, as Leroy McKeever, in his state of mind. Anybody with authority, because Jack Johnson had refused his request for personal leave to go home. He's having problems with his wife, or there's something going on there. And Jack went on R&R, so McKeever was intentionally going up to the orderly room to kill Jack Johnson with his grenade. En route, there's a couple guys seeing that he had a grenade. He took it out of his pocket, was walking with it. God only knows what he's thinking. All he wants to do is kill someone. He's drunk now. I'm sure he's not aware of the repercussions of what he's doing. So on the way up, two of the guys tackled him, tried to get the grenade away from him. At that time, he pulled the pin on the grenade and said, "You better get the fuck away from me or I'm going to blow you both." These were friends of his. One was a black dude, and another guy was a door gunner that knew him. And no one could reason with him. Danny tried to reason with him on the perimeter. Mm-hmm. "Don't do this." So he got up, he pulled the grenade, and now he's walking up to the orderly room, and he runs into the first sergeant of 603rd is Joe Helby. Mm-hmm. So they're having a heated conversation. Now, you've got to understand, I wrote into the CID to get I have the whole transcript from what happened. Mm-hmm. I'm not making any of this up. This is written down.
Yeah.
So they get in a heated conversation, and, you know, McKeever's swearing at him, "You motherfucker, I'm going to blow you up." And there's a crowd of people starting to gather because, you know, the word goes through the company like the wind. Yeah. So they start gathering around him. So they had talked him down. They had called to get the MPs over there from the 101st. Said, this is in the works while all this shit's happening. They'd already called to say that we've got a problem over here, big time. So they're standing around, and all of a sudden, McKeever, they were talking through it, and McKeever put his hand out to, to shake hands with Helby after this heated exchange, and he had forgotten that he had pulled the pin out of the grenade, and he just let up a little bit on the handle, and you could hear the detonator pop. Now, everybody knows what that sound is. Everyone scattered. Joe Helby and McKeever are standing like this, like we are. They both froze. They didn't run, and the grenade went off between them and just blew them to pieces. Three guys got wounded that were in the area from the grenade. One of McKeever's arms was completely blown off and was laying on the ground, and our company mascot, which was, we had two dogs. One was called Spider and one was called No, that was the monkey.
Oh.
Spider and Webb. Spider's Webb, right? So one was Webb, and the other one was the spider. Webb got killed, got run over down by, when we were at Dao Chang, someone backed up and ran over and killed him. All our mascots got killed, just like that war. Monkey, one of our pilots killed the monkey. It was like the monkey from hell. It used to bite everybody. And so no one really liked it. We had it around, but it used to shit in its hand and throw shit at you. And it'd go into our tents. We had it on a long leash. And so it could move around the trees and that, but it'd always go in and shit all over the hooches and all that. Okay, but back to the other mascot. Now, Webb, he picked up this guy's fucking arm and takes it up to the mess hall, and he's eating this guy's arm at the mess hall. So one of the captains took a .45 out and killed the dog. And let's see, that's what happened. That was the only grenade incident that happened during our time in Vietnam. Now, these two guys that got killed, I personally don't think it should have happened. It should have been dealt with long before this. The guy should have been sent out of the unit. Jack today has problems with that. He wrote the foreword for the history. Mm-hmm. You'll see it at the reunion. And he's had problems till this day about that incident. Because this guy was coming to kill Jack. The only reason he didn't is Jack was on R&R. Or Jack might have got blown up. You know, something that he'll never forget. None of us will ever forget it. It was such an unbelievable thing to happen. Yeah. But we did have a fragging during our time over there.
Now, earlier you had mentioned some guys would go back and smoke a joint and unwind. Other guys drink to unwind. Was drug use prevalent in your unit at all? Or?
Not really, just weed. See, during that time frame, there was no heroin, any of that stuff going around. I'm sure it was available. Our unit wasn't into it. We were really an isolated area, so you know most of the bigger base camps and that would start having those problems. But that was later. During our time, we smoked weed. There was a number of guys in the unit that smoked weed. We never smoked when we were in combat. We knew better than that. It was moderate use. We weren't abusing it. I mean, you couldn't abuse it because you had to watch out for the officers that was trying to bust you. Mm-hmm. What we'd do, we'd go out by the perimeter where they burned the shit, and we'd smoke by these, they call them honey pots. They're 55-gallon drums cut down about here, and you pour kerosene in. Because of the water table, you had to burn your shit. Mm-hmm. You couldn't bury it because it ended up coming back up. Mm-hmm. So we'd go out there and smoke the weed out by the honey pots. Like, I mean, this weed was so strong, Steve, that one or two hits and you were just blitzed. You'd be sitting there holding a joint in your hand and it'd be out. And we'd just sit out on the perimeter at night and watch the firefights and, you know, artillery strikes and trip like that, you know, for, I don't know, a couple hours, and then we'd hit the sack. But at the time, we used to get rationed 2 beers and 2 sodas a day. So what the heads would do, well, we were the heads and the juicers. That's what we called each other.
Yeah.
We know, everyone knew who was who in the unit. So we used to trade our beer rations to the juicers for their soda rations. Because when we were smoking the weed, we wanted soda. We didn't want alcohol.
Yeah.
So it worked. It worked for us. But there was no heavy drug use in the unit. Not during our time.
Where would you get marijuana?
Oh, we'd buy it from any of the kids around the base camp. It cost $20 a kilo. Or the Vietnamese are into the barter system. We used to trade them soap or sea rations. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways, they'd throw it over the fence from the road. I showed you how close the company area was.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, yeah, they used to throw it... Yeah, this is a perimeter road that went around. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it was available everywhere.
Yep.
Little kids would come up and sell it. You know, them people were poor.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't cost anything to grow marijuana over there, you know. So, Anyway, one way we get it is they would throw it over the fence to us in some kind of a container, mm-hmm. and then we would put something, money or whatever we were going to do, throw it over the fence. Make sure that the MPs had gone by. Mm-hmm. You know, we were hip. We knew how what we had to do to get what we wanted.
Yeah.
In other ways, is when we're out on missions or on standby somewhere. They'd come up, they'd approach you and ask you if you want to buy weed or get some boom boom.
Mm-hmm.
So it was either getting pussy or weed.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd get both. You know, we're just youngsters.
Right.
But yeah, like I said, there was a number of people. Some of the officers smoked. It was discreet. It was a coping mechanism, just like drinking after being in combat all day. You either want to come back and get shit-faced drunk or smoke a joint. And that's what we chose. I mean, we did our fair share of drinking, but when we didn't feel like drinking, we just puff a little weed and unwind that way.
Now, you said some officers did. Was that something that the officers usually didn't do? Or was it...
Well, you got to understand, most of the great majority of the officers were warrant officers. And regular line officer that went to West Point or something, they didn't respect warrant officers. They didn't think they were shit. So you had that little struggle going on within the company. And I got, you know, these warrant officers, we had our share of shitty pilots, but I'd say 90% of the pilots were good, very good. And they were young, 19, 20. They were as old as we were. They're flying the choppers.
Right.
And we had a very good rapport with our, at least in second platoon, with the pilots. And I remember every once in a while they would come to me and ask me if I could get them some weed,
mm-hmm.
which I would do.
Yep.
So everything was kept real discreet. Like I said, it wasn't abused because there was no time or place to abuse anything.
Mm-hmm.
We were always flying, you know, or...
So is that kind of the rule, is you could kind of do what you wanted as far as either smoking pot or drinking?
Yeah, they knew. I mean, even Jack will tell you, he knew that there was marijuana use in the company,
yeah.
But all he'd want to know is, well, where are they getting it?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in fact, the supply is unlimited. Wherever you are is where you're going to get it.
Right.
But, you know, they had inspections, spot inspections. Matter of fact, referring back to the weed thing, you know, we had to hide it wherever. You know, we had our hiding places in sandbags or wherever. But a funny incident, since we're talking about the weed, there was one guy who came to the unit with me, this Mike. He was, I can't think of his last name offhand, but this guy was out there on guard duty one night. Guard duty. We didn't smoke weed on guard duty. This guy was smoking weed on guard duty, and First Sergeant came by DePaul. He had the balls to ask DePaul if he wanted to smoke some weed with him in the bunker. So right away he called the MPs, got this guy arrested. So they took him in, and plus he was growing weed underneath the hooch. He had plants going. California guy. You know, at the time I was from Minnesota, so
uh-huh.
You know, he'd probably been in weed before he went into service. I mean, I never was into drugs till I got in Nam. That's when I first smoked weed.
Mm-hmm.
Someone else turned me onto it. One of my hooch mates. So anyway, he gets busted, and they court martial him. They take him to Gucci. They're going to court martial him, and at that time, the military code of justice didn't have marijuana. As a restricted substance, wasn't on the list.
Mm-hmm.
So he walked. He beat it, but he had to go back and DePaul had him on every shitty detail, and then he finally transferred him out during one of our infusions. They had a lot of infusions over there. You understand how that worked?
Well, the infusion, as far as after you had suffered so many losses, they'd bring in new guys? Or
no, infusions, to keep the continuity of a company, if everybody was going to leave on the same day, you wouldn't have a company.
Right.
So what these infusions did would bring say 15% of your guys would be transferred to another unit,
okay,
and 15 guys from their unit would be transferred into your unit with different DEROSes.
Yeah, okay.
The time you left country.
Okay.
So what it does to a cohesive unit is fuck it all up. These guys all train together.
Yeah.
And once they got to Nam, they started transferring out to all these different units. It was crazy. I mean, that part of how they ran that war was bullshit. Well, you ended up, we didn't fight 14 years over there. We fought one-year wars. Because you had a 365-day tour.
Right.
Then you got another guy coming in that don't know shit. It's going to take him 8 months to get his shit together.
Mm-hmm.
So once we knew how to fight that war, tactics and everything, we left the country. So all your experience left. I mean, it was crazy, that whole concept.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever talk about that while you were in Vietnam?
No, this all came later. We're just too focused on staying alive and day-to-day shit.
Yeah.
Didn't really focus on anything, a bigger picture.
Yeah.
Our big picture was just staying alive.
Yeah. Any multiple tour guys in your unit?
Yeah, there was. Jack Johnson. He was on his second tour.
Mm-hmm.
He got wounded on his first tour, and he asked to get the command of the 188. He was a battalion at the time, so he got that job. But a lot of the guys that came over with the unit were our second tour guys,
mm-hmm.
so that helped. Anybody that was a career soldier was going to see two or three tours in Vietnam
mm-hmm.
during their time.
Mm-hmm.
Me being a draftee, I knew I wasn't going to be seeing any more time in Vietnam. They tried to get me to extend 30 days for an early out. I wouldn't even do that.
Mm-hmm.
When we were up at Ellsley Sally, that was such a scary place up there, flying in the mountains. There was no place to go down.
Mm-hmm.
And I got shot down with 10 days left in country.
Wow.
It was the last day I flew.
Mm-hmm.
We were working up, doing an insertion up in the mountains, and We took a bunch of fire and knocked out our hydraulic lines. We just made it out of the mountains, late afternoon, went down a rice paddy next to a small village. And we had two Cherry pilots that were just new to the unit, right?
Mm-hmm.
They got into the guns. And me and Greg, we'd been there a long fucking time. Like I said, I got 10 days left. I'm at the top of my game at this point in the unit.
Mm-hmm.
This fucking guy comes in, it's almost dark, with all his landing lights and shit on, right next to the... You figure at night, everything's controlled by the enemy.
Yeah.
You know, wherever... If you're not in your base camp, you figure everyone around you is the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we go down, guy's got all the fucking landing lights on, like you're fucking at a drive-in or something, and he's telling me to take the miniguns off the ship. I said, hey... Sir, if you want the miniguns taken off the ship, you're going to have to do it yourself, because Greg and I grabbed our 60s and as much ammo as we could carry and set up a defensive perimeter around the aircraft, because
yeah.
we thought we were going to receive fire from this village.
Mm-hmm.
While this idiot's out there with all the fucking lights on. And I told him, you know, I figured I'd get Article 15 or court-martial. It didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
I was freaking. I had 10 days left. And this fucking guy's telling me to take the guns off. I said, no, sir. I said, if you want the guns off, you take them off yourself. I'm going over here on this berm, and I'm going to get undercover, and I'm going to watch that village to make sure we don't receive any fire from it. So about 10 minutes later, Slick came in and got us. Nothing was said. I think he got the point. I think he learned something that day
mm-hmm.
because of me going off on him. I think he opened his mouth. He talked before he thought it through.
Mm-hmm.
So... nothing happened, and like I said, that was the last day I flew. And I left the day of the change of command when Jack Johnson had his change of command with this Hank Dreher.
Now you said that you were shot down.
Yeah.
What were the circumstances behind that? How did that happen?
Well, we were working an insertion up in the mountains.
Yeah.
We were a light fire team. We were the gunships would go in to draw fire off the slicks.
Yeah.
That was our job. So we go in and try to draw fire to see where these guys, the bad guys, were, so we'd open up with rockets and miniguns
right.
and our door guns.
Yeah.
So during the exchange, we took a bunch of fire, and it knocked out our hydraulics.
What kind of fire was it? Was it
a AK-47?
AK-47s? I didn't know if it was heavier anti-aircraft guns.
No, they had 51 calibers up there. We experienced 51 caliber fire up in that area. And down south we did, too. Yeah. We took 51 caliber fire. That's like a golf ball coming up at you, a tennis ball. Mm-hmm. That's what it looks like in the air. You know, and it slid up. Mm-hmm. So basically, at that time, I believe it was AK-47 fire. That was their basic weapon, so that's what I'm assuming it was. Because we were a little shook up at the time. You know, it was a trip on what kind of weapon it was. I could hear a lot of shit going through the helicopter, I know.
Yeah.
So anyways, but we did make it out far enough to go down before we lost hydraulics completely. But the whole control panel was all lit up with warning lights. Mm-hmm. So we did take a lot of hits. Like I said, then they came in and picked us up, and then they came in and sling-loaded the gunship out of there.
Mm-hmm. Was it standard operating procedure for a pilot to turn on all his landing lights and everything else?
I don't think so.
If they were shot down
in
enemy territory?
When we flew at night, standard operating procedure was to fly with no lights.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, we had a mid-air collision, and Tuiwa flew hip and lost two gunships. We lost eight guys when we worked with the Koreans up in Phu Hip. We worked with them for 2 months. They were on a night recon mission, and they lost visual contact, because they didn't have no lights. That was SOP.
Yeah.
And one of the gunships banked into the other one.
Oh,
killed all eight guys on board. There wasn't much left of the choppers. I think I got a picture of it. And so this is after the mortar attack at Daochang.
Mm-hmm.
They sent us up there to build our morale back up, and then we have this devastating mid-air collision with killing eight of the spiders, the gun platoon. So that we really had a tough time of it as a unit with these accidents and shit that were happening. And, you know, I mean, a helicopter just melts down to nothing. There's a sign for camping there. That's the main gate sign. The airfield's in the background. That's the other main gate. I mean, this collection is unbelievable. Here's the airfield. This is where we got mortared. All the ships were along here. Company area is right along in here. So there's a road here. We'd either walk to the airfield or we'd all jump in a three-quarter ton and get someone to drive us out to our aircraft. But anyway, this was the layout. We call it the web.
Mm-hmm.
Every unit called their, like the Robin Hoods used to call it the forest, I think.
Yeah.
They all had different names.
Sherwood Forest.
Yeah, Sherwood Forest, yeah. So ours was the web. You know, the Black Widows was really a neat nick. I guess it was a nickname, right, for a unit.
Mm-hmm.
And with the spiders. So, I mean, I'm really proud of our unit, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
This is the Michelin Rubber Plantation factory where they process the rubber.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Nui Ba Din in the background. It's called Black Virgin Mountain. It was the highest point in the Three Corps.
Mm-hmm.
This is basically another shot of the company area. You can't see the pool on this one, but it was right in here. And there was a snack bar right next to it.
Uh-huh. And this is the trees.
This is the rubber. This is these mansions were unbelievable that the French had built in there.
What were they used for?
The mansions?
Yeah.
Oh, that's where they lived.
Oh, they were still there?
Yeah. Yeah, I told you, this guy came in twice. I think every Thursday he flew in from Saigon, stayed in the mansion, and then collected money from the military for damaged trees. Can you believe that shit?
Scam.
Okay, here they are right here.
I didn't know if I didn't know if the commander and the staff commandeered the mansion to make it into like a talk or something.
Some of the mansion buildings were used for headquarters.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, like you say, the commander's 3rd Brigade was in a villa.
Yeah.
So, I mean, all the high-ranking guys were in the villas.
Yeah.
Air Force was in the villa.
Yeah.
We were in the tents.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is what's left of the two ships from the mid-air collision. And I got this from a guy in California before I left. He was a safety officer at that time, and he had to do the investigation.
Yeah.
These are actual photos that were taken by the military.
Yeah.
10. Eight of our guys got killed on that one. This is another one we put together for the reunion. They're ready to frame. This is a night gun run on the village of Dao Chang. It's a time, we call it time shot. Like we left the shutter open. The ones going straight down are door guns, and these are minigun fire. But that's all the patches from, well, it's not all of this. I've located some more since we did this one. But
that's great.
That's the only pictures that I know of that incident.
And that was when you were supporting the Rocks.
Yeah, we supported the 9th Rock Division, the White Horse, and the Capital Division, the Tiger Division.
Yeah. Now, what were they like, the Rocks?
They were the best. They were the best fighters that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
In my opinion, when we worked with them, you got to understand that these Orientals look at life a whole lot different than we do, and the way that they do their missions. I mean, if they're working in an area and they receive fire, some of their people get shot, they go into the closest village and they kill everybody. So what happens, the VC give the Koreans a wide berth because they know they're not going to, they know how the American military does their thing. What they can get away with, but see, they couldn't get away with this shit with the Koreans because they were brutal.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I ever got turned on the cap sheet, I don't know if you've ever eaten it, but it was something.
Mm-hmm.
We worked with them for about two months up there, and we did take some wounded up there on the mission. Some of the guys got wounded, but as far as contact, there wasn't much contact because. Like I said, VC and NVA gave these guys a wide berth. They stayed out of wherever their area of operations was because they were brutal.
Yep. Now, you said they'd go into a village and kill everything. Could you define that for me?
Defined everything.
Yeah.
I can't because I don't
like
have that
Mili,
knowledge. I don't have that Mili knowledge.
Everything or?
I don't think, well, let's say whatever it took to get their point across. Let's put it that way. I wasn't in the village personally when they're doing this, so I mean, this is hearsay.
Yeah.
These are rumors that were. Some of the guys that were on the missions were aware of it. I didn't go out to any villages that this happened, but they weren't massacres. They didn't wipe out everybody in the village. I think what they did was to get the point across, they would kill a few people in that village.
Mm-hmm.
Say they lost three people on their patrol, they probably killed three people in that village.
Mm-hmm.
Just to let them know that we know that these guys got to be coming from somewhere. And basically, that's the way I see it.
Okay. Anything else about the Rocks strike you as unique? What about their leadership?
Leadership was brutal. We used to see them, they were into this, some kind of martial arts.
Taekwondo.
Taekwondo, okay. Well, they'd form a circle. I did see that. They formed circles and they would do the Taekwondo. That was part of their program. I mean, that's, for self-defense and that. But I did see a couple officers actually go up to guys that had fucked up and they would knock them down, hit them, physically abuse these guys, not verbally. So their discipline was different than the American soldiers, where you might get verbally abused, but you wouldn't be struck.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that there was instances of that, but I didn't see any of officers striking enlisted men. But with the Koreans, I did see it.
But did you ever hear? Did you ever hear verbal abuse or verbal?
Well, yeah,
investigation or
with the Koreans?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, we heard it, but you didn't know what they were saying. Yeah, but you knew he was hot.
It was in Korean.
And one guy's doing all the talking, right?
Yeah.
And these guys, you could see the fear in these guys' eye from this officer, going off on them, and they wouldn't take a step to fight back either.
Okay.
Alrighty. You know, they have that much respect for this officer, you know, no matter what the situation was. Mm-hmm. This is what I, at least this is what I saw. But I saw on one instance where an officer, they had this guy's heels locked, and he hit him a few times, slapped him, hit him, knocked him down. You got to understand, you're in a war, you're in a combat situation, and things are different.
Yes.
The Americans weren't going to go in and tell these Koreans how to fight their war. No. They're going to fight it the way they know it worked. I mean, look. They just come from their war.
Right.
But they were brutal. And I enjoyed working with them because we didn't get hardly any contact up there.
I was just going to ask you that.
Yeah, so that's why I like this. Huh?
There weren't many Hanalzees?
No, not with the Koreans. Well, the word was out, don't fuck with these guys,
yeah.
You know. So, I mean, we really enjoyed it. Plus, we stayed at Phu Hip, was right on the South China Sea,
mm-hmm.
Sandy Beach. So we got to go down and, you know, go swimming in fucking water. It was crystal clear.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, thing about South China Sea, whenever we wanted to bore in our weapon systems or anything, we'd fly out and find sharks. Because
mm-hmm.
It was so crystal clear, they'd be swimming around up by the top of the water, and we'd come in and make gun runs on and shoot up the sharks.
Mm-hmm.
To sight in our weapons and minigun and stuff.
Yeah.
So it was kind of neat. That's how we used to go fishing.
What about killing other wildlife?
I have to admit, we did kill a number of water buffalo.
Yeah.
Yeah. If they were in the area when we came in, we usually shoot, we usually kill them. And that was the farmer's tractor, so he'd be pissed off.
Yeah.
And we'd end up having that someone would have to pay for that water buffalo.
Yeah.
That's all. That's what it all came down to, was cash.
Yeah.
No matter what you did. You know, if you blew something up, you had to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how they worked that. It was the major infantry division that handled that,
mm-hmm.
With the killing of the water buffalo and that. But, you know, we had that mindset that we're going to kill any fucking thing out there, I'll tell you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because when we're going in there, they give you an idea. It's supposed to be a hot LZ or, you know, we have free fire zones over there. We used to go on these things called vulture flights.
Okay.
It was in a free fire zone. When we were down south, it was around the Iron Triangle.
Mm-hmm.
What they did, they dropped leaflets, told everybody that they were to move out of the area, even though they'd spent their whole lives living in these farms, and
mm-hmm.
they told them they had to leave. So if they didn't leave the area by a certain date, that there was a chance that they're going to get killed because it's going to be a free fire zone. I don't know how they put that, how they exactly put all that together. All we knew was that we were told that it was a free fire zone, and we called a light fire team go out there, call them vulture flights. So anything we seen out there, we could kill. And that's what we did. So anything moving, we'd go in and we'd kill it.
Mm-hmm.
And, what a name for that kind of operation, vulture flights. But there was a lot of free fire zones down that area because it was out in the jungle, and there really wasn't that much of a population out that far.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few people, but that's why they turned them into free fire zones. They, you know, the few people that were there, they tried to get out of the area and relocate them, and that didn't work. And people were poor. They didn't have any money or anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to take them, put them over here, and they don't have any place to go. They don't, you know, it was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that my feeling, it was wrong to relocate those people.
Mm-hmm.
But with the politics of war took over, and that's what happened. It, you know, they relocated a lot of the villages and areas that we worked. Because
mm-hmm.
Basically they're VC controlled, and the VC would come in and use the locals. They would take their food, you know, because they didn't, you know, who knows? These people, a lot, like the MVA was from North Vietnam. They didn't know the terrain around down south. So the VC, the local communists, would be their guides. So they'd come into the villages at night and get food and stuff from the villagers. So our military, to relieve that problem, would just move the whole village.
Mm-hmm.
problem gone. They didn't give a fuck about what it did to the people, as long as they knew that they weren't going to be able to use that village for supplies or, you know, bunkers or ammo, you know, hiding places.
Did your unit support the relocation of villagers as far as using your air assets to actually transporting them? Or
no, I think that was the mule skinners. They were CH-47s, the big, the twin choppers. They used them. They put the cattle, everything. They'd walk them in, you know, because they hold jeeps and trucks and everything. So, yeah, they just round them up. They'd have a pickup zone, and they'd bring all their belongings with them and pets, chickens, whatever, pigs, and they'd relocate them to another town. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head where these relocation places were, but they were. There was quite a few of them around. Turn them into just refugee camps, basically.
Now, did you guys talk about this kind of stuff?
No. We didn't think much of the Vietnamese. At least the few. I mean, the people that I hung with. We couldn't speak the language. I mean, right there you got a big problem. You don't know what they're saying when you're talking to them. You know, I mean, what are they planning? You know, you have it always in the back of your mind that these guys are trying to kill you. I mean, who can you trust? You can't even speak the language. You can't. So we're just leery. We always had a loaded weapon with us too. I mean, make sure you had a loaded weapon with you wherever you went, just in case. I couldn't imagine walking around only without a loaded weapon. You just never knew who the enemy was. They could be, like I told you, the barber. One day he's cutting, giving you a shave, and the next day he's trying to blow you up. So I'm sure, like, we had 17 indigenous workers there. I would imagine 25% would probably be C. You got to understand that the village itself, they were VC. So, I mean, any people we had working in town had to be VC. You know, just to make any sense, why they even brought the Vietnamese in to do that work. You know, I mean, it made it a little easier on us. I mean, they cleaned the hooches, they filled sandbags, they worked in the kitchen, you know, doing KP. But just the idea that you got the enemy in your company area, they knew everything about us from the inside. Kind of scary when you think about it, you know. At the time, I didn't really trip on it.
Well, but yeah, especially when you couple that with what you said was understood at the time that was an enemy village. I mean, and that was explained to you at the time.
Yeah, it was a VC village. Yeah, it was off limits.
Off limits.
There had been GIs killed in the village. There were stories of guys being killed in the village. They were in there getting pussy. And while they were getting fucked, they came in and they killed everybody. They killed the women that were with them, killed these GIs. There was a number of instances, a number of the guys that I've contacted from the infantry units that were based there. Had stories about Dao Chiang that these guys just wanted to get laid and they end up getting killed. Yeah, it was strictly off limits. You did not go in a village. And then they put an aviation unit right across the street from a VC village, controlled village. You would think the aviation unit would be on the other side of the base in a more secure area. It didn't make any sense at all. To this day, I can't believe that we were put at that location. And I imagine most of the guys haven't tripped on it in depth as I have, but at the time it didn't even seem like it was a good idea. You know, and when Jim Merriman, he was a battalion CO, he's been helping me with the text for the 269th story that I'm putting together. And he said originally he tried to get the Black Widows to be stationed up at Tain Inn with the Blackhawks because it was a bigger base camp and more secure. See, Dao Chiang was the smallest of the base camps for our battalion that where we were stationed. Both places that we were stationed at, LZ Sally and Dao Chiang, were very small base camps in comparison to what was out there. and we made the best of it. We had a good time. We, you know, we got away with a lot of shit. We did a lot of crazy stuff. But I guess you had to do that to keep focused, to keep your sanity. If you didn't get into trouble, then you weren't doing something right. That's the way we look at it. I mean, what are they going to do, send us to Vietnam? That was our mentality. Fuck them lifers. You know, you got all these career soldiers, and after basic and AIT, I couldn't understand how anybody could spend their whole life in the military. I couldn't put up with the bullshit structure. I mean, common sense has nothing to do in the military. I couldn't live in that environment. I knew that as, you know, shortly after I was in the military. But some of these guys, you know, I mean, it wasn't for me. Even some of the officers that I flew with, my second platoon leader, he was a commissioned officer. When I did finally find him, he didn't want anything to do with the unit history, and I flew with this guy all the time. You know, and if you couldn't even talk with the guys that you flew with, there's something going on there. He's got to have some problems.
Did he say why?
Well, he said, he didn't elaborate. Mm-hmm. But he was a commissioned officer. He did his minimum time in the military and got out. Okay. He's doing good, married, family, lives in Pennsylvania. But I do pick his head from time to time. I got his email, so I fuck with him every once in a while. You know, I told him, I said, Johnny, I'm going to keep it easy, but I'm going to keep you posted on what's going on. Because I know he wants to know.
Yeah.
Because he was there. I flew with him.
Yeah.
So anyway, I've been bugging him because he took 8mm film over there.
Uh-huh.
So I've been bugging him for about 2 years. We put one video together. Mm-hmm. And like I said, we got three to show at the reunion.
Yeah.
So I quite enjoy those. One, Charlie Maurer. 2 years later, I get this package in the mail. Charlie finally put it on a VHS for me. And I ain't heard from him in a long time. And finally, I had gotten three emails from the guy within a day or something. I'm thinking, God, this is the most I ever heard from this guy. He wanted to find out if I had received the video. So I emailed back, you know, I told him, I got the video. I'm going to show it at the reunion. You know, I got in touch with him before I came out here and told him what we planned on doing. Plus, we put out a newsletter once a year, so try to keep everybody, you know, in touch with what we're doing, trying to do. But a lot of, the warrant officers, some of them stayed in. You know, it was on an individual basis. It's how you accepted the military. Can you hang with this, or... But no, I got most of the guys. There's a number of guys in the unit were draftees because the draft was going at that time, and you know, we were 2 year guys. And we referred to everybody that wasn't a draftee as, a lifer. We used to always have turmoil with the RAs, regular army. Like your service number is either U.S., blah, 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 or RA, regular army, or U.S. was draftee. And we used to get on those fucking guys and say, yeah, we're out of here. You got another year to go. Because if you enlisted, you had to do 3 years.
Yeah.
Drafted was two.
Yeah.
And we knew that these guys, they weren't enjoying the military. They definitely were not going to make it a career choice. But we used to dump on them every chance we got that they had to do one more year of stateside duty. Which was all spit and shine. There's nothing for you to do, so they got to keep you busy, right?
Yep.
They got to make sure your shoes are shined and... ridiculous. When I got back to Fort Hood, you got to understand, I used the M60, I qualified expert with it, I used it for a year in Vietnam. When we got back to Fort Hood, the first class they gave us was on the nomenclature of the M60 machine gun. So, I'm taking this class that I could be given the class, but you know, I mean, this other guy's giving the class on it. It's kind of funny. Why would they keep me in the military? The draftees, they should have cut them loose after Nam.
Yes.
That's the only reason we were drafted, but that wasn't the case. So most of us that were drafted still had 5 or 6 months left to do when you got back. For your 6 months of training and a month vacation and a year in Nam. So you usually had 5 or 6 months to do, and they didn't have anything for us to do. or anything that was going on was Vietnam, and they knew they couldn't send us back. That's why they tried to get us to extend for 30 days to at least keep you and an experienced soldier in theater. That would be 30 days that you might be able to help someone, some of the new guys, give them some of your, share your experience with them, keep them alive for their tour. And really, there was no point in keeping us at all. They should have cut us loose, but that wasn't the way it was. They sent us back to hang out and have these meaningless classes until our time was up. And in our instance, we got sent up to the riots up in Chicago. And that, when, I was bitter as hell when I got out of the military after that fiasco up there. Fuck, we got spit on. They're throwing garbage at the bus we were in. You know, it's really, really sad.
Before we talk about that, let me ask you a couple more questions about Daqiang, and I want to ask you about the Tet Offensive, too. You mentioned the hostility in the village, the fact that it was off-limits, it was a VC village. Did they ever attempt to pacify that village, you know, bring in supplies and medical
stuff? Yeah, they had.
Try to win it over?
Excuse me, were you going to go and talk with Frank?
I'm sorry, Frank.
Yeah, the officer I told you about.
So, you were going to explain about the pacification that went on in downtown.
Oh, okay. 25th Infantry Division, they had pacification programs trying to win over the hearts and minds of the local Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. They put together soccer teams and stuff like this. Food was donated. But all this, you know, the funny part was they didn't want to be won over. Mm-hmm. They were VC. You know, they were so, and then plus the South Vietnamese government, they've been so oppressed by the South Vietnamese government for so many years. I mean, there wasn't even any government post south that far. Like I said earlier, they'd already, what do you call it when you give it up?
Surrendered?
Yeah, they'd already surrendered the area to the VC, that it was controlled by them, and so they pulled back their forces.
Yeah.
You know, so these people that they're trying to win over aren't, they're Viet Cong, they're, you know, that's where the politics comes in. I mean, all they were was villagers and farmers, is basically what it was, and then we're going to come out there and then tell them that there's going to be a democracy now,
yeah.
They're going to be free elections. So that's why we were out there to push democracy. It was a joke.
Now, what happened at Tet? Tet 68.
Tet 68. We got involved with that big time.
You were at this point. You're at LZ Sally. Or you
no,
still
we're
down
again. Okay. We were there for Tet 68. Believe me.
Okay.
I was flying guns then.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, we started getting hit heavy mortar attacks the end of January, probably all of January.
Mm-hmm.
Well, from November 9th on, we had major mortar attacks at Daqiang. Like I said, I got scrambled. I had to fly counter mortar. See, we had to keep a light fire team on strip alert at night for if we got mortared, you'd send them up. We'd locate the mortar tubes, either take them out or call in artillery, and they'd take them out. So I had to fly that night. It was my birthday. That's why I'll never forget it. I had to go up and fly. Nothing happened, didn't get shot down or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So then the 31st comes, and we didn't get hit like, we got mortared, but we didn't get hit like Benoit and all the, everything that's ever been written about all the other places. The 101st NVA Battalion Regiment was in the area, that they were the closest enemy unit to us. I had the whole, this is Tet 68, that's the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's everything on it. It's got maps, it shows where the enemy units were and everything. So that's like that's priceless.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time when Benoit got hit, the 25th Division was spread out, before Tet 68, 25th Division was on Operation Yellowstone up by the Cambodian border. Well, their commanding officer through intelligence, knew something was going on, so he pulled these guys back in. Okay, 25th. 25th was the, we were the defense, we were the outside circle of the defense of Saigon. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we were getting these guys right at the border when they first came into the country, but they were trying to infiltrate into Saigon. Mm-hmm. Basically, that's how it was working.
Yeah.
And Dao Chang area is one of the staging areas, and Iron Triangle was one of them. Mm-hmm. So when the shit hit the fan, we got caught up. We were on call. All the gunships in the 269th Battalion were on standby for close fire support for the three-quarter cav that was sent from Cu-Chi to open the road and relieve the siege on Benoit. Mm-hmm. We were part of that reaction force that... I wish I could get my wording down here better. To come to the aid of these guys that were getting overrun at Benoit.
Mm-hmm.
So when they made their mad dash down one, the NBA had set up ambushes all along Highway 1. That was the main highway.
Mm-hmm.
For the whole country, it was the main highway, actually. You know, it was like Highway 1 in California. You know, it was the main artery.
Mm-hmm.
So when they left Cu-Chi, they got ambushed at a place called Apcho and Cu-Chi City. The NBA had built reinforced concrete bunkers along the roads. So they knocked out a bunch of their APCs now, just a mech unit,
mm-hmm.
tanks and
yeah.
APCs.
Mm-hmm.
So we get scrambled in the morning and we're over at Cu-Chi City. I remember being in Cu-Chi City. We used to go in there and get pussy and hang out. You know, it wasn't off limits.
Mm-hmm.
But now when Tet started, the NBA moved into Cu-Chi City and took it over, and Apcho, this was another small village close by there. And I remember making gun runs down the main street of Cu-Chi during Tet. We burned down most of the buildings on the street. That was another thing we did when we were, as far as the gunners or Cu-Chis are concerned on the gunships, is we'd see who could start the most buildings on fire. I mean, we were into it, you know. I mean, fuck, I was in a war.
Mm-hmm.
And every fifth round is a tracer, so it had sulfur on it, so it'd be easy to ignite anything that was dry. So anyway, we ended up burning down most of the buildings in Cu-Chi. Took fire, mm-hmm. gave fire,
mm-hmm.
And we supported, our battalion ships were the basic air support as far as gunships for the three-quarter cav. When they made their dash to Benoit to relieve the siege down there. We were part of that little battle of Tet 68,
mm-hmm.
which was was a major one, even though it didn't get the publicity like Kaysan or Wei. You know, that's why I'm trying to tell our story, because we've seen as much as anybody that was over in that country, and we didn't get any kind of press release or coverage or anything like that. That bothers me.
Yeah.
I think our unit should, you know, I'm proud of our unit. I think that we should have been recognized. We should have got some recognition that we didn't get. You know, besides the bullshit with the anti-war movement, that's a whole other issue.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always been a historian. I always liked history, let's put it that way. And I thought, hey, what could be better than to write the history of my time in Vietnam and my unit? So that was one of the reasons why I'm doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And the other would have to do with the guys that are on that wall down there. Yeah.
Well, why don't you talk a little bit about that operation during Tet, where you went down and helped...
Well, it's not really much to say. We were in the air, and we're on the radio, ground contact with the ground commander. He's telling us where the fire is coming from, like we can't see it,
mm-hmm.
because they're firing at us, too.
Right.
So we're trying to take these guys out, but a gunship, unless you get a direct hit with a rocket inside the bunker, I'm sure you're not going to do nothing in that bunker, right? These are concrete reinforced bunkers they got.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to bring in... like 106 recoilless tanks. They had the tanks there, but see, they were, these guys were set up. Their job was to make sure that no one got to Benoit. Any reaction force, that was their job, is to ambush everybody that came to the rescue. Mm-hmm. So they were in place. They were ready for them. Mm-hmm. And they knocked out all kinds. I got some pictures of it from the air, but a bunch of APCs that were knocked out on fire, tanks. Mm-hmm. It took out a lot of them. I mean, we got the job done, but a lot of guys got killed. Mm-hmm. During that operation, none of our guys, but the guys on the ground, got their ass fucking whooped. I mean, they put a whooping on them boys too. But you know, in the during this whole thing, they're both sides lose, you know, taking a lot of casualties.
Yeah. Did you guys ever actually fly missions into Benoit to support them, or is this mostly?
I think some in the battalion did, but I don't think, you know, I don't know. See how it worked. They had. You know, they might only needed one or two ships or something out of your company, and you wouldn't even know about another cruise mission for the day. Because if we didn't have a combat assault or something, mm-hmm. you're always sent out on missions. Might be one or two ships. We'd go over to Coochie or down to Saigon, Benoit. Because mm-hmm. the ground units would be always asking for air support, so we'd get a mission to go work with the 199th or the 1st Infantry Division or the 9th. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we flew all over the area. Vung Tau, I mean, that was what was nice about flying. I mean, it was beautiful over there. Yeah. I never seen a country so beautiful in my life. It's lush, green, and then all of a sudden you'd fly and you'd fly up on these B-52 craters, you know, and look like a bunch of, you know, big round holes in the and this lush vegetation, you know, mm-hmm. you could just get a little feel for that, that there's something going on here other than, you know, today's Wednesday.
What about river traffic and operations against riverine supply missions and stuff like that, the VC or the PAVN would engage it? Because you, as you pointed out, your base area around Da Chang was right there on the Saigon River. So did you guys have a lot of missions where you went and shot up barges and stuff like that? Or
we used to shoot up the sandpans.
Sandpans?
Yeah, those convoys you're talking about, they ran convoys from Fukong, which was just south. That was the province capital for Binzong province. That's the province we're in. Mm-hmm. And that was right on the river. And they used to run river patrol boats up there every day, convoys of them, like 10 to maybe 15 or 20. Mm-hmm. I got them right in our daily reports mention it also. Sure. What they would do, they would paint a Vietnamese flag on the top of them.
Yeah.
So from the air, we knew that they were friendlies. And we used to fly the rivers. Matter of fact, we worked with Navy SEALs down in Na Bay, mm-hmm. flying close in air support. SEAL Team 1 down there. Mm-hmm. Best food I ever had in Vietnam was with the Navy. They get the best food, mm-hmm. let me tell you.
Yeah.
So anyway, we were crazy. We used to fly over the sand pans and try to hit the gooks with the skids. Mm-hmm. For fun. That's what we're doing for fun. You know, trying to unwind. Low level right on the river.
Mm-hmm.
We used to do a lot of low leveling.
Yeah.
And people would be running to get out of the way. Wouldn't be firing at them. We were just trying to hit them with the skids.
Yeah.
But you got to remember, we were young kids and we were, you know, a little mischievous. You get away with as much as you can.
Right.
So that's why we ended up doing half that crazy stuff. But yeah, we did fly cover for patrol boats, and if we got clearance on sandpans, once we got clearance, we'd take them out. Rockets, miniguns. So, but we had to get clearance first. I mean, you had to get clearance to wipe your ass, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they had the rules of engagement were a joke over there, you know, where you couldn't fire on anybody. Mm-hmm. You couldn't fire on anything unless you receiving fire already, even though you could be looking at this guy that's going to shoot at you,
mm-hmm.
with this NVA uniform on,
So we didn't. We disregarded that most of the time. If we seen the guy, we don't know. But there were shitty rules of engagement that came down from higher up that we used them for toilet paper. But there's a lot of stuff that didn't make sense over there under a combat situation where I'm sure it was like that way in Korea in World War II, too, you know, rules of engagement. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you had to wait until you received fire to return fire. And like I just said, we didn't do it that way. I would rather be in prison alive than in a box going back to the States. Mm-hmm. And that's the way most of us looked at it. Pilots, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, we left Vietnam, came back to the United States. Shortly thereafter, you found yourself in Chicago, the Chicago riots.
Yep.
You want to elaborate on that a little bit more?
Okay, get back from now, get a 30-day leave, we go home, it's the 4th of July. So I'm in the kitchen having bullshit with Ma. And some of the kids in the neighborhood are firing off M-80s out in the alley. Mm-hmm. Next thing I know, I'm laying underneath the kitchen table, just reacting, you know, after a year of Nam. And my mom just, she don't know what to think. So I just told her, sorry, Ma, I'm just having a little, you know, flashback here. So anyway, I did 30 days back there. We sent all our money home from now. Mm-hmm. We played cards over there. We used to win a lot of money playing cards. So, and we're doing a little black market stuff too over there. So I got to send my whole check home. So when I got home, we had enough money to buy our first new vehicle. Mm-hmm. And Dave and I bought the new Super B, Dodge Super Bs, 383, four-speed, high-performance, the muscle cars of that period. And so anyway, we took my Super B down to Fort Hood. And my other buddy, Point, he bought a new 396 Super Sport in Washington. He was stationed there, and we met down at Hood. So we used to always drive into Austin, Texas. When we got off work, you know, like at 5 or whatever, we'd drive into Austin and party down there. And we got caught speeding on post a couple times. I stopped and pulled over. Point kept going. The MP just said, I'm going to let you go, but you tell your fucking buddy in that Super Sport, I know his car and I'm going to find him. So that was the only thing that ever happened with dragging on post. So we're down there. We're not doing anything. We're just putting in our last 5 months in the military. You know, they have no use for us. We lived through Vietnam. They can't send us back, but we have to fulfill our military obligation. So we're down there, and in August, I don't know, August 8th or whatever the Democratic Convention was in Chicago, they had problems with the rioters, the anti-war movement. Hoffman and his group were out there, and the local police couldn't handle the situation. They called the National Guard. They were the next level. We got put on alert down at Fort Hood. They took our whole battalion, put them on C-141 Starlifter, the big ones, flew us up to right outside Chicago and bused us to Great Lakes Naval Station. That's where they put us up. I don't know how it came about, but Dave Huggins, my best friend from Minneapolis, we went to high school and grew up together. We spent our whole time in the service together, you know, in the same bunk bed. Mm-hmm. You know, it was one of those weird times when it did work, except for in Nam, we were in different units. So they full battle dress, M16s, you know, field packs, helmets. They fly us up there, they bus us over to Great Lakes, and then on the way into Great Lakes, they're waiting for us. The anti-war movement is waiting for us. They're spitting on it. They had screens on the windows, mm-hmm. like they did now, so you couldn't throw grenades in the buses. Mm-hmm. They're spitting through the mesh on us. They're throwing garbage against the trucks. It was just an ugly scene. So we get in there, you know, we're talking, none of us wanted to be there, believe me. These are all draftees mm-hmm. in the unit. No one wanted to be there. They just want, we just want to get out of the military. So I don't know who was, whoever was in charge, but I don't know if they seen on our DD-214 that we were door gunners or whatever. Dave and I got put on as a two-man sniper squad mm-hmm. with a Jeep, with a M60 mounted on the back of a Jeep. Mm-hmm. And they told us if we get called in, if there's any sniper fire in Chicago, you're going in there, you're going to take out the person that, the perpetrator, you're going to take them out. You know, we're looking at each other thinking, I don't know if I can do this, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I was ready to kill somebody in the streets of Chicago. Mm-hmm. Luckily, they didn't use us. National Guard took care of the problem. Mm-hmm. We stayed up there a few days. They flew us back to Fort Hood. And on that note, when I left the military, that was my last, those were my closing thoughts when I left the military, is how they used us and abused us. I was real bitter. Dave's still real bitter, too, about it. I'm sure everybody that got sent up there, anybody that had to deal with any of that anti-war movement shit that was a veteran, I think he has to be carrying some kind of ghost about it. Because it was hard enough to come back to the States. And I mean, when I landed in Washington State, when I got off the plane, I kissed the ground. I was so happy, so proud to be back. And then they told us, we got debriefed when we came in. They says, if we think for your own safety, you'd be smart not to wear your military uniform home. And we were proud of the medals and shit, you know what I mean? We were proud mm-hmm. to be alive and back. We didn't realize the depth of the anti-war movement. I mean, that, you know, just happy to be home.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. That's what we did. We took off our uniforms, put on civilian clothes, got back to Minneapolis, ended up getting in many heated arguments with people I grew up with over Vietnam, to the point where for 20 years, I never told anybody I was in Vietnam. 15, 20 years. Because I didn't want to hurt you. And then I decided that, you know, fuck this, this war ain't never going away. Fuck it, I'm going to write it. That was another one of the reasons that I'm doing this. Mm-hmm. It's got to be told. Our story's got to be told. Those are probably some of the most, talk about times in this century, the 60s. I mean, unbelievable. I mean, even when I got out of the service, I dropped out. I became the people that were at those riots. I grew my hair long, I dropped out, I was got into drugs. I was selling drugs in Minneapolis. I didn't follow the war. I did not demonstrate. Believe me, I would not demonstrate against those guys over there. But I basically dropped out into that subculture for years. Even Carmen's an old hippie from the 60s. You know, we're from that generation. And I'm proud to have gone through it. I mean, to think that we're alive today is saying something after what we've been through in our lives. Mm-hmm. After Vietnam, getting into the drug culture, that whole game. Mm-hmm. It's been quite a trip. Quite a trip. So we did good?
Yeah, so this will end the first interview with Dick Dietrich.